Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Test Talks. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. And this is a podcast for anyone who wants to discover how to succeed with testing and automation, as well as find out what works for testing any software development project. This is hands-on knowledge you can put to use right away to save yourself time and headaches. You will hear what it takes to achieve automation awesomeness. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Our cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up now at saucelabs.com/signup. Select the free Your Plan option and click the link I have a promo code to enter TestTalks14 to get 20 hours of automated testing for free for a plan that never expires. Today, we'll be talking with Troy Hunt about how to security test your APIs. Troy is the author of multiple Pluralsight video courses like Hack Yourself First, How to Go on the Cyber Offense, and Hack Your API First. Troy is a software architect lead for a Fortune 500 healthcare company. He's a Microsoft MVP for developer security and ASP insider who's been building software for browsers since the very early days of the web. He blogs regularly about web security at troyhunt.com. He is also the author of the OWASP Top 10 for .NET Developers series and the free ebook of the same name. Troy can also be found speaking at some of the biggest conferences for security. So we're about to get schooled on how to hack our APIs. So if you like breaking things, and if you're a tester, I know you do, check it out. But before we do, I just want to give a shout out to DevBYJ and Aragon731 for being cool enough to rate and review Test Talks in iTunes. And if you go to iTunes and leave a rating, hopefully a 5-star review, I'll give you a shout out in an upcoming episode. Hi, Troy. Welcome to Test Talks.
G'day, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yes, I am, as you can probably hear, an Australian. I am an Australian Microsoft Most Valuable Professional for Developer Security, which is a very nice award they give me. I'm not a Microsoft employee, but they give me a nice little recognition for the things I do in the developer security space, and particularly in the internet security space of web apps and APIs and all things HTTP.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm really excited to have you on the show today. I recently took one of your Pluralsight courses, How to Hack Your APIs. Can you tell us why you think API security is so important?
Yeah, I guess there's a few different things there, Joe. So one of them is that when we look at the web holistically, vulnerabilities in web applications in many ways are much easier to find than in APIs. So a really good example is the use of SSL. So you go to your bank, you see HTTPS in your browser, you see a padlock icon, you can look at the certificate, you get this sort of assurance that your credentials and then all the information coming back is going to be secure. Now flip that over to the mobile app world where you've got a custom-built app that's doing some sort of web communication in the background and you get none of that. So you get no assurance of who it's talking to. You get no assurance of if it's talking to it securely. So that's one thing. The other thing is that these apps tend to gobble up a lot of nasty security implementations. So, for example, on SSL again, if you go to a website in your browser and the certificate is invalid, there's bells and whistles and bright lights that go off everywhere. In your mobile apps, you see nothing. And as it turns out, a lot of mobile apps are either not using SSL correctly or at all, or they're using things like invalid certificates. So they've basically got very, very poor implementations. So that's one. And I guess the other thing that's really significant here is that we do have a bit of a gold rush, if you like, of internet-connected things, whether they be apps on mobile or whether they be the physical things in this new Internet of Things world that we're entering. And what tends to happen when we have this gold rush of people trying to rush stuff to market is shortcuts get taken around things like security. So I guess a combination of that sort of little bit more abstraction between the consumer and the actual services that are being hit and the rate at which these things are going out makes it a little bit of a perfect storm for vulnerabilities in our APIs.
Great. Yeah, I definitely agree. It's a timely course. I read somewhere that in 2020, there would probably be over 50 billion objects connected to the internet. And I assume most of these things would be headless API type transactions going on. So what would you say are the high level concepts a test engineer new to API security testing should know in order to get started?
Look, a couple of things. And I think that one of the most significant things that will be new, probably to a lot of testers, certainly testers that are more, functionality centric, and certainly something that's new to a lot of developers, is that all of the communication that your device is having with these HTTP-based APIs can be observed, can be intercepted, and can be manipulated. And that, to me, is sort of what I see being the light bulb moment for most people, where they go, oh, okay, so every time this app, which I've built and I sort of quote-unquote own, I trust, is talking to these services that I also built and I own, yet someone is able to sit in there in the middle and see what's going on. And not only can they do that for HTTP-based communications, but they can do that for HTTPS-based communications if you install a self-signed cert on the device. So I think the number one thing here for testers and developers alike is be conscious that everything is, for all intents and purposes, in the public domain. So that's where I'd start. And I think then in terms of testers, it comes down to understanding what are some of the common patterns of risk or really just poor implementations in many ways that we find in these APIs. So things like insufficient authorization. And a really good example here is the app trusting that the user is successfully authenticated before it shows things, but those things have already been sent down over the wire? So a really good example that I often use of this, because it's not sort of too sensitive, is British Airways. The British Airways mobile app, when you open that guy up, it goes out to the internet and it pulls down all the Wi-Fi passwords for the lounges. Now, you're not meant to see those until you actually authenticate to the app, yet it's already grabbed them, pulled them down over the connection, stored them in the device, expecting that you'll authenticate, but you can just jump in the middle and intercept them. So they're the sort of patterns that I often see that I think testers need to be aware of.
Your course is really eye-opening. I would recommend to anyone listening to head on over to Pluro's site and sign up for a month and just try it out. This course is awesome and so eye-opening because you actually give real-world examples and you walk us through and show us how easy it is actually, like you said, to intercept the messages and communication going on. And you know, I was just shocked on some of the things that you can actually find out about. What is a man-in-the-middle attack? It seems to be one of the more common security attacks a hacker would use.
It's certainly one of the things that we most commonly defend against. So a man-in-the-middle, in a very broad context, is effectively some malicious party sitting between a communication that's happening between two parties. So if we think about this in a web context, if you've got a browser talking to a server and it's connecting out via, say, your home router and then out to your ISP and then across the internet to a server, what happens if the ISP is monitoring your communications? And we see this happen a lot overseas, and ironically, we know it happens in the US now via the NSA, and I'm sure that if our government has enough money, they're probably doing it too. So a man in the middle is where there is someone sitting in the middle of that communication. And of course, this is why we have this thing that is SSL or TLS or HTTPS. We tend to use those terms a bit interchangeably, where we have end-to-end encryption of the connection. It's to ensure that if anyone does sit themselves in the middle of that communication, they can't either observe what's going on and they also can't manipulate what's going on. So a lot of people forget it's not just about making sure that your things aren't seen, it's that your things aren't changed as well.
I think another example you gave in the course is how you can intercept messages from your mobile phone, but also things that you wouldn't think of. You have an example of an internet scale, how even though you can't interface with it directly, there are ways that you can still hack into that and find the communication that's going on between it.
Yeah, so this is where it starts to get really interesting because, as you mentioned before, we're getting all of these internet-connected things. We're entering the world of IPv6 and everything with publicly addressable unique IDs, and we're sort of getting to this point where, and I'm not sure why, but our fridge needs to talk to our toaster, needs to talk to the kettle, and all of these things are sort of connected. And, of course, the interesting thing here is that all of these connected things, when they do talk back to services centrally, that they do tend to talk over HTTP or HTTPS, and all of those things are interceptable. So even though we might not be able to, say, go to my bathroom scales, I've got a set of those nice Withings scales, I can't go to those and change the proxy to send the traffic through Fiddler like I show with mobile devices in the course, you can still intercept that traffic. So I could ARP poison the device, so have that device route its traffic through another intermediary, which then dumps all the packets that are going through. I could connect that device to a malicious wireless access point. So you mentioned Pineapple. There's a device called a Wi-Fi Pineapple that acts as an access point that you can connect to like any Wi-Fi connection and dump every packet that goes through it, and we can then inspect that. So the message there for something like the scales, or you can even get a connected fork these days. All of these things are connected. So for all of these things, we can look at what are the services they're talking to, what's the data it's sending, and also how the service is responding. All of that can be observed and all of that can be probed.
Interesting. So someone listening that might be new to this or haven't seen the course might say, big deal, of course all the data is encrypted. So who cares if people could see the communication going on? What would you say to that?
So we got to separate the issues. So one of them is confidentiality, insofar as can a man in the middle, let's say the NSA, because it's still kind of topical a year later, let's say the NSA is looking at what my body weight is. So we're not too worried about that. At least I'm not too worried about that. I don't really care if the government wants to see my weight. What's more interesting, though, is if I'm an attacker, and I have the scales, a set of scales, and I actually look at the traffic patterns and I look at the services that it's calling and the data that it's sending, could I possibly then exploit those services? So once I've discovered them, for example, the service which brings back data, can I change my user ID to someone else's user ID and get their data? Okay, so can I actually subvert the authorization protocols that are in there and pull back information I'm not meant to get access to? So that's the sort of thing that we're more worried about in a case like the scales.
What tool do you normally use to capture this information?
So the easiest tool that anyone can use to go and test this sort of thing now is Fiddler. And Fiddler is a pretty popular tool among many developers, and many of them use it for debugging so that they can look at the HTTP request that the PC they're running it on is sending to a service or to a website. And what a lot of people don't know is that Fiddler can actually act as an HTTP proxy. So when you go into the settings in Fiddler, there's a connections tab, and you can say allow remote connections. Now, as soon as you tick that guy, you can go to your iPad or any other device that you can configure a proxy on and tell it to use the IP address of your PC as a proxy. So effectively, what's happening now is everything you do on that device is now routed through Fiddler. So just like you can open Fiddler and see all the requests from your PC, you can see all the requests from this external device. And that's how simple it is to actually find how the device is communicating with the back end. Now, the other thing that then leads on to is that you can use other tools within Fiddler to probe away at the way the service is operating. So, for example, you can use Fiddler script to modify the request or modify the response. So in the course, I show how when we log on and we get a response that indicates I'm not an administrator, what happens if we use Fiddler script to change that response and say, look, I am an administrator? How does the app respond differently, and is there a vulnerability in that?
A lot of this seems kind of manual. Is there a way to automate security testing, or is there a way to run known attacks than maybe a test suite of security tests you could run against your APIs? Or is it really more of a hands-on kind of hacking away to discover what those particular holes might be in the API that you're developing?
It's a bit of both. So certainly there are tools that can automate security analysis. I wrote something very recently about a tool called NetSparker, which is very good for testing website security, where you just plug in the root URL of the website and it crawls through and makes tens of thousands of requests and looks for common vulnerabilities. you can use that to some degree for your APIs, but the APIs don't tend to be discoverable in the same way that resources on a web page are. You don't have hyperlinks to resources that can then be easily discovered. So I think for testing APIs, it is a more manual process. Some of the automated tools are still good for looking at, say, server configuration vulnerabilities. So is it leaking information that shouldn't in terms of, say, internal error messages or excessive headers or things that it doesn't need to disclose? So the tools are good for that. But particularly for APIs, you really want to look at what is the device doing, how's the device communicating, and then try and probe away at I guess, really the business logic and the semantics of how it works. And that's something that's a lot harder to automate.
This brings up another question I think about, especially for a team that's new to security testing. You know, they have a two-week sprint, and they have a lot of things to have on the definition of done, one of them, say, being security testing. So where in the software development lifecycle do you think security testing should be performed? Is it a one-time operation, or is it an ongoing event that you normally do throughout the lifecycle?
Yeah, everywhere. that's the easy answer. So look, it often tends to be a very retrospective sort of event. But one of the things that we know from building software is that the further down the life cycle of development a change is made, the more it costs. So for example, if we can change the way we want the thing to operate in the requirements phase, it's much cheaper than in the design phase, which is much cheaper than in the development phase, which is a lot cheaper than the test phase. So the earlier we can make these decisions and solve these problems, the better. So for me, that boils down to a couple of different things. And one of them is having well-trained developers that actually understand the security paradigms. And that's really why I write these courses, because those are the guys that we most want to influence. Because if we can get those guys right, when we do security scans right at the end of the project, we're going to find a whole lot less stuff and it's going to be a whole lot cheaper to fix. Now, we should still do that. And I do like the idea of having dedicated security professionals who may not be developers and frankly, many times may not even be on the same planet as them. But they come at things from a very different angle with a different view, and they usually find things that the developer won't. So I think it's good that they are in the process as well. Now, it then becomes a question of, are we working in some sort of iterative, agile fashion where we can do that multiple times throughout the project? That's always a good thing. Or at the very least, let's make sure we do that at the end. And of course, the life cycle of an app doesn't just end when we release it either. So is there any sort of continuous monitoring? The number of times I've seen someone push a change where they just change the error configuration to debug something, and then 6 months later, it's still spitting out internal implementation data. So an ongoing continuous analysis is also a good idea.
So Troy, besides Fiddler, what are your thoughts on Wireshark or Metasploit?
So they're both very interesting tools. So Wireshark for packet capture and analysis. So you're really getting down beneath just the HTTP level, which is where Fiddler tends to live. And you are getting down to individual packets across all sorts of different protocols. So that will get you right down to the metal and it will get you a lot of detailed information. It's harder to get your head around as well. It's harder to digest than just one HTTP request, because now it's a series of packets that you now need to sort of associate back together and draw some conclusions from. So very good stuff, but requires some attention to get the most out of it. And Metasploit, being very penetration tester-centric, it's a pretty serious product made by a company called Rapid7. I've seen some of what Metasploit does, and it scared me, it confused me as well at times. In many cases, we are getting down to some very, very low-level stuff. But what tends to happen with Metasploit is that when a vulnerability arises, they get modules built onto it pretty quickly. So we're talking about this the day after a fairly serious vulnerability has been released to the web in terms of this bash bug. Inevitably, we will see a Metasploit module, if it's not there already, I'll be quite surprised, which will help penetration testers find at-risk systems. So it's a very, very full-on piece of kit aimed very squarely at security professionals.
Great. But it almost sounds like Fiddler to get started is more than enough. It'll get your team talking about security and finding issues probably right off the bat. And I believe in your first Hack Yourself First, you actually go into it in detail how to use it. So it gives you a good overview to get started.
Yeah, correct. And the reason why I advocate Fiddler is that for the audience I speak to, which is developers, it's a familiar tool that you can get your head around very quickly. I think if I sort of introduced developers directly to Wireshark, they would kind of go, oh my God, what is this? which is what I often do when I open it up. Right. So I think Fiddler is a good kind of low friction way to get started doing this. And frankly, when we're talking about looking at HTTP traffic, it's all you need as well.
Are there any security frameworks or best practices that are well known that people should be following?
Yeah, so OWASP is a really good resource. OWASP is the Open Web Application Security Project. They're a very well-renowned not-for-profit organization that produces a number of different artifacts about web security. And one of the artifacts they produce is called the OWASP Top 10 Web Application Security Risks. And in fact, I've got a number of courses on Pluralsight about that as well. And that tends to be a very good go-to resource for securing your web apps. And they do also have one for mobile too. They've got one specifically around mobile, not necessarily specifically around APIs. That probably falls a bit into both categories. But they've got great resources, and I find that they tend to be really good reference points where I can send developers, or in my normal work, if I get anything outsourced to vendors, I find that that's a really good place to send vendors in terms of these are the security standards that we expect. And hey, it's an open, not-for-profit organization without a vested interest in any one given technology, too. So there's a language that we can all talk.
Is there one thing you see over and over again that engineers designing APIs are doing wrong that expose their APIs to being hacked?
I think the most common one I see is improper SSL implementations. And improper is a bit of a broad term, but it's sort of the things we covered earlier on. So not using it at all is a very improper use. The other one being not validating certificates. So there's a really interesting trick I show in the course where with Fiddler, you can load a certificate onto the device. So, you know, yes, you can effectively compromise your device and you can see all the traffic of apps that are doing it properly. But if you don't load the Fiddler certificate on the device, but you tell Fiddler to intercept SSL traffic, it re-signs the traffic with its own certificate. So by the time your device is actually loading this HTTPS address, it's getting a certificate that's not valid. Now, the interesting thing there is, does the app then say, hey, this certificate is not valid, you shouldn't be here, or does it just simply process the request? And as you would have seen in the course, Joe, some apps, even some very prominent apps, just happily process the request because they're not doing validation. And developers do this because it makes life easy. So they're building services there on their local PC. Let's not worry about going out and getting a proper certificate from a certificate authority. What we'll do is we'll turn our own self-signed one, which won't be valid on the device, so we'll turn off certificate validation and then they just leave it off. And I've seen banks do this as well. This is not just, you know, some guy in a garage made a bad mistake one day. This is multi-billion dollar organizations. So that was actually an interesting one when I found that one.
Wow.
It happens.
I was reading the comments and someone actually mentioned that they implemented some of the recommendations you showed for SSL certification and they found an issue within their application. So the things you talk about are really real world and you can apply them right after.
Yeah, that's it. And look, honestly, in the time we've been talking, the 20 minutes or so, anyone listening to this could have easily gone out, proxied their data and found a whole bunch of issues in their apps. I mean, not an episode goes by where I don't go, hey, let's have a look at what's happening on the iPad and we'll see crazy stuff. It's not always security as well. I'm preparing for a tech ed presentation for Microsoft here in Australia, and I thought I'll have a look at the Evo car mag, the English mag, and I opened it and I just sort of left it. I came back and looked at my Fiddler 5 minutes later and it had downloaded 200 megabytes worth of data just to open this app. So, all right, that's not a security issue, but do I want to be sucking down 200 meg over my very limited down here in Australia 3G, 4G connection? It's just amazing the things that happen behind the scenes.
It really is. And I think also you did have an example of something similar to that where you were opening up an application and showed how much, like, why is this data being pulled down? It's a PNG. If it was a JPEG, you'd save so much more space.
Yeah, that's the other one. It's a bit like what I sort of explained at the start with security, where it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. It's that much harder to see when you do something bad with even just your general optimization. So I think I've got a blog post out there from a few years ago. I found one of our pay TV providers, when they downloaded the thumbnail images for the channels, so these are images that are sort of 80 pixels square, they're all like 1.5 megabytes because they had the original sized images. And what was really funny is the guy who was responsible for that got in touch with me and said, well, look, that's just the way they gave us the images. And I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, we do have the technology to, you know, maybe smoosh those down a little bit, but it is interesting.
If I have client-side validation going on to make sure there's no funky data that's being passed to my API, should I consider my API safe?
So I don't like ever kind of getting to the point where we say something is safe because it's such an absolute kind of statement. And I, you know, we all sort of draw real world analogies to try and explain technology paradigms. But I think it's a little bit like saying your car is safe. Some of them are pretty good. If I'm riding around in a Mercedes S-Class, I'm probably going to be more comfortable than in a, you know, a cheap machine from China somewhere. But, it, you know, that doesn't mean that if you drive the thing 100 mile an hour into a brick wall, you're going to be okay. So I think that in terms of things like the client validation, it's the same message that we've always had with the web, which is validation on the client is fantastic because it's very responsive and it gives you a lot of immediate feedback. But it needs to be supplemented by validation on the server. And really, you've got to do it twice. Some frameworks make it very easy to do it twice. But you've got to do it on the server because the client can be circumvented. And exactly the same logic applies with APIs.
Awesome. That's the reason why I asked the question, because I know in the course that you said, even if you're having client-side validation going on, you still need to have the server ensure that what it's getting is correct, because there are ways to go around both the server and the client. So you want to make sure you have it on both ends, I believe.
Exactly. And then this is one of the reasons why I like using Fiddler a lot as well. And obviously in the course, we look at things like the Composer feature in Fiddler, where you can reconstruct your own requests. And of course, you can always go and do that with curl or wgetter or anything else that you want that can issue an HTTP request. But when you take the client out of the picture altogether and you take out all of the safety nets that it had for you, things tend to open up a lot more and you see things in a different light. So that's one of the other things I'd suggest. Just look at the HTTP requests and focus on those and forget about the client and see what you find.
Just because API communication occurs under the covers and you don't see it, do you think some developers get a false sense of security that no one is really going to poke around to find their API's vulnerabilities?
Oh, absolutely. I think developers of all sorts of software get that sense where it's like, hey, no one's going to look at my things. You know, it's all good. But I do think that, again, just the nature of API-based communication behind rich client apps being that further out of sight makes that scenario worse. And what I try to explain quite frequently is you've got to assume that the attacker owns the device, the attacker owns the connection, and they can manipulate anything at either of those points. And once you start to think that way, you start to think about risks in ways that you wouldn't when you assume that everything is just working the way that you designed it to work.
I also was reading an article recently that talked about how I work for a healthcare and that hackers getting healthcare information is more valuable now than Visa information. So along those lines, we're developing REST APIs where I work. So is there anything that's common that people, when they're developing REST APIs, are doing to expose their REST services to be easily hacked?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I, by day, work in healthcare as well, and I'm sure I can compare notes off air. So I get to give it a good bit of thought as well. I think one of the things that comes up a lot there, and it's not just specific to this industry, is even just not expecting services to be discoverable. So I wrote something a few years ago that got a lot of press, which was about we have a shopping center here in Sydney, a Westfield shopping center, and they're obviously all over the world. And they had a service where when you drive into the car park, you know how you see the little lights on the roof and it tells you how many parks are this way and how many parks are that way? So they've got this service where the little sensors on the roof also have cameras and they look at the number plates. And if you lose your car, you can pull out the app and you put in your number plate. And the sensors have done this OCR and it will show you which cars it thinks are yours. And it carefully limited it to 4 cars so that you couldn't sort of go through and mine the data. And it obfuscated number plates and things like that. And what these guys were doing was that they were actually returning a lot of data in the background. So they were returning the plain text number plates. They were limiting the results to 4 by query string. So you could change it to 4,000, you know, and you'd get everything. So the thing I see there in answer to your question is, one, returning excessive data. So a lot of these services are returning data in excess of what you need. So if we put it in a healthcare context, you know, if you're loading records via an app, do you really need to pull back someone's birth date? Do you need to pull back their blood pressure? Do you need to pull back all the other attributes of the entity that might exist in your internal system? So you want to think about keeping that to an absolute bare minimum, because it's a lot harder to lose data that you're either not sending or that you don't have. So that's one. And the other one, and this goes back to that Westfield case as well, is that often I'm finding that it's easy to discover other services once you know where some of them exist. So in that case, it was very easy to discover where is the service that actually sends back the list of number plates. Oh, by the way, if we traverse back up a directory, here's the services that allow you to control the shopping center systems. And those are publicly displayed. So we're often finding that there are a whole range of other services that you can easily find. And we have things like WSDLs, web service definition languages, that can make discovery very easy. We have automated documentation for a lot of APIs these days that also make it easy. So we got to think that once someone is able to discover where an API is, they're inevitably going to discover other things about it as well, which you may not have intended them to.
I've seen developers a lot of time, they have stories that they may not have taken into the sprint, but they'll create a REST service that returns back pretty much anything possible, even though they may not be implementing it in that sprint. And it may come to a point where they'll never use that data, yet they've already exposed it. So that usually causes an issue. It's bringing back more than what they need, but they're assuming they'll use it later, and sometimes they don't even use it later.
Yeah, often I have a discussion on a similar vein, which is someone will say, look, we're building this system and we need to capture birth date. I'll say, look, do we really need to capture birth date? Because that's actually personally sensitive information. Now, if we lose that, we're going to have serious problems. We've got to sort of weigh that up against the upside of what are we actually going to do with it? If we're just capturing it because we might want to use it one day, then that's a bit of a problem. Or can we meet in the middle? Can we capture age or like a year of birth or something like that? Can we try and sort of water down the risk a little bit? So I think there's a lot of discussions you can have there to try and reduce risk without necessarily taking anything away from the business requirement.
That's a good point. Sometimes we just do something and maybe we don't question enough. Just having that conversation, by doing security testing, you'll probably flush out a lot of issues that people that never even thought about. So I think that's a good point.
And, you know, along those lines as well, one thing that tends to be quite risky is service reuse. So someone will say, look, we've got two different use cases where we're consuming two sets of data, but there's a whole bunch of common stuff. So what we're going to do is we're going to have the one service, and the one service will return all this. And that's a good sort of software development code reuse objective. We all try to do this. What you got to remember, though, is what can often happen is you've got very different security profiles consuming those two contexts. So you might not want to return some sensitive data to the public consumer of the service, but you do want to send it to the administrative consumer of the service. So would it actually be better to break that service into two different resources and only send what we need to who we need to send it to? Might be a bit of duplication, but it could actually be a more secure proposition.
Wow, it's like a security design pattern almost.
Exactly. And it also goes to this concept of a principle of least privilege. So how can we make sure we only give people just what they need to do their job and nothing more?
So what do you think is one of the key takeaways someone could take from this conversation moving forward with their security testing efforts?
Sort of the key messages are just to try and encourage people to get in and look at apps. And I'm going to say this generically, not just your own apps, go and look at other people's apps and be nice when you do, because you will find things. But I find that when you start to look around at the broader spectrum of how these apps are operating, you're probably going to be a bit scared and disappointed, and that's maybe not always a bad thing. But you do tend to start picking up on some of the patterns that you probably don't want to see in your own apps. So, you know, go and sit down one afternoon for an hour or so and proxy your traffic and just start opening stuff and see what it does. And I don't think it's just me, but it's quite a fascinating thing when you do.
I agree. I mean, just like I said, watching your training video and seeing what's actually being exposed really blew my mind. So I can't wait to start it on my network and take a look at some of our applications to actually see what's being passed back and forth. And I think it's actually going to help start some conversations around security and start questioning things. Like you said, do we really need to expose this? And if not, you know, maybe we should just have a little foresight and take care of it now before it does become an issue.
Yeah, and also ultimately going back to the title of the course, Hack Your API First, the whole premise of this, and this is actually a follow-on from another course called Hack Yourself First that was more web browser-based centric, all of this is about how can you find vulnerabilities in your own things before other people do. And my belief is that unless developers build up the capabilities to actually exploit these risks, it's very hard to defend against them. So yeah, sort of take the time to put your attacker hat on and you know, really try to hack yourself like they would hack you.
Okay, Troy, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their API testing efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
So the one piece of advice is proxy your device. So proxy your device, run your app, watch what's happening. That's just the number one thing, and everyone can go away and do this right now. And if you're not sure, just Google proxy whatever my device is via Fiddler, and you'll find it in a few minutes. Contact-wise, I am at Troy Hunt on Twitter, just at Troy Hunt, and my blog is troyhunt.com. And most of what we spoke about here is, if it's not in my courses, it's in my blog. And my blog has links through to all the courses and an email link and all that sort of thing as well. So they're the best ways to get in touch.
Awesome. So I'll have a link to this and everything of value that we talked about in the show notes at www.testtalks.com/21. That's it for today's episode of Test Talks. Thank you for joining me. And as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.